Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, October 21st, 2008 Carrboro Board of Aldermen meeting. John Herrera is running a little bit late, but he will be here shortly. No.
Yes. He's on his way from Raw.
Okay. Is there anybody who came to speak on a matter that is not on our printed agenda? Okay. Mr. Manager, consent agenda.
Item one of the consent agenda is approval of the minutes of the previous meetings of October 7th and 14th. Item two is award of construction contract for the James Street sidewalk bond project. Item three is a request to set a public hearing on a land use ordinance text amendment related to water quality buffers. Item four is an appointment to the Environmental Advisory Board.
I have one small change on one of the minutes. October 14th, page two, with regard to the bicycle destinations, it says, I suggested Smith Middle School be added to the list, and I think we actually said Smith Middle School and schools on Soul School Road. So it was Smith, Soul, and Chaplain High.
Okay.
With that correction.
Second.
Been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously. Mr. Manager, item D1.
Okay. This is a presentation on the Historic Carrboro Plaque Program, and Tom Wiltberger, a member of the Appearance Commission, will present an overview of the program and its purpose. If the Historic Carrboro Plaque Program is approved, the fee will need to be approved and incorporated into the town's miscellaneous fees and charges schedule.
Good evening. Thanks for having me. My name is Tom Wiltberger. I'm a member of the Carrboro Appearance Commission and Historic Preservation Commission. This is Catherine Devine, former member of the Appearance and Historic Preservation Commission and one of the core members of the committee that helped to organize the historic plaque program. Another member of our committee should be coming. Her name is Cheryl Forbes. She was instrumental in helping us pull this together. I was here almost 2 years ago, kind of at the inception of the idea of the Carrboro Plaque Program, and since then we've accomplished a lot. I'm kind of here to update you on where we are now, where we're going, and hopefully get your buy-in on really truly launching the program tonight. So we're excited to be here. Quickly, initial work began 2 years ago, as I mentioned, kind of came up with the idea. At that time, we came up with a purpose and a description of the program. I'll read those to you briefly just to remind you, and then we'll talk about what else we're doing here in the next 5 minutes. The Historic Carrboro Plaque Program seeks to recognize structures of historic character and relevance in the town of Carrboro by designating them with specially designed plaques. These programs are common throughout the country. It's a completely voluntary program, and each property owner submits an application if they're interested in research to have their property designated with a historic plaque. We came up with a five-fold purpose, the first of which was to preserve and promote Carrboro's architectural history, to generate awareness of Carrboro's mill town history and heritage and evolution, to set the stage for walking tours and seasonal house tours, and to encourage and motivate owners to maintain their property's appearance and structural integrity, and finally, to build a sense of community amongst historic property owners and citizens. In the last 2 years, we've done a lot of researching programs across the country, trying to figure out which aspects of their programs work well, which ones don't. We've come up with plaque design through a competitive competition we ran early in the spring amongst the Carrboro art community. We've had a lot of meetings. We've talked to a lot of people, from preservationists to architects to historic property owners. We had a public meeting, and it's kind of all coming together tonight, and we've actually awarded two plaques and hope to kind of begin our marketing campaign to get this thing, you know, get it really rolling. It's the kind of grassroots program that I think will, once folks see some plaques around town, it'll make them more interested in participating. I do have some thanks to give to a couple of folks, or a number of folks. Many of the folks that we talked to are listed there. And at the bottom, these specific organizations, Belladamas, Open Eye, Jay Bryan, James Harris individually, Cheryl, myself, Catherine, also contributed money to the program. We came up, we fundraised $500 to award the winning design of the plaque. So in the spring, we had a little bit of press related to the plaque design competition, and we kind of put a shout or a call out to all the artists in Carrboro and Chapel Hill saying, we need a cool, you know, nice design for a historic plaque. We didn't just want to put a piece of plywood up and hire a sign maker. We wanted it to be a little bit uniquely to Carrboro, or unique to Carrboro. So one quick thing I want to do tonight is recognize the artist who has the winning submission. Her name's Linda Mazura. She's here tonight. You're going to see her design in the sample here that we brought. It's very nice. I'll pass it around. And I actually have it's signed by Julius S. Carr himself, and it's from the First Bank of Carrboro. And the check number is 1933, which is the age at which your house has to be older than built in 1933 to qualify for the program. So thank you, Linda.
Well done.
She's already spent the real money we gave her, so this is just for show. We are launching the program officially tonight. As I mentioned, the design has been finalized. It's an incredibly attractive and durable and I think really representative kind of what we're trying to establish here. We wanted something with permanence. We wanted something that was going to be weatherproof and reflected a little bit of the architecture of Carrboro. You see in the upper right-hand corner, there's an actual photograph taken from a mill house where they have decorative gable vents, and the mill house architecture in Carrboro is, for the most part, fairly simple in design, and this was one of the few sort of special features that the builders of those homes would mix up or throw in there to kind of give the mill house a little flair. So Linda picked up on that twirly pattern from the gable vent and mimicked it in the plaque design. So we're excited about that. In your handout tonight is a very thorough four-page description of the program, including the qualification criteria for a property, and this would apply to both residential and commercial properties. We want participation from both. Other thing we did as part of developing the program was really try to make it easy for the building owners to do the research. There's a very thorough list of resources for research, how to go through the process to research the history of your property. And it's not just researching the property. We're trying to kind of archive some of the stories and the people that lived in the houses as well. So you'll see in the sample application that's been passed around that, you know, we're asking, who lived here? What did they do? How did they use the property? What kind of influence did they have in the town? So we're looking to kind of fold the heritage and the architectural elements together and archive all this stuff for the long term. The program hopes to get its own website where all these materials will be viewed online. In the interim, we're going to ask for a little bit of assistance from the town in making the application and the resources document available online. We've put a committee in place to review the plaque applications. That consists of five members, the three members that started the program, Catherine, Cheryl, and myself. Lauren Branford from the Appearance Commission, who's also an architect, and Richard Ellington, who's here, who's kind of the local Carrboro historian. He's done a lot of presentations on Carrboro history. So we've got a good committee, and we're going to put this thing out there and hope that the applications pour in. I should also mention it's a very affordable plaque. Some of the programs that we researched, such as Wilmington, North Carolina, the Historic Society wants $250, $350 for a plaque. We found a vendor that can make that plaque that I showed you for roughly $120 shipped. So it's great. It can mount to the side of a building, or it can be mounted in the garden on a stake. So that one will be installed soon. Go ahead.
I have a kind of off-the-wall idea that you're perfectly free to reject, because that happens to me a lot, so I just preference it with that.
She's used to it.
I'm used to it. It would be really cool if you all had a float in the Christmas parade, and, like, somebody could make a little cardboard Carrboro house, mm-hmm. and, you know, historic Carrboro, and then, like, the website where is your house historic,
idea.
Too?
I think my house you could just lift up and put on your back.
We could put your house on
that
there.
Sounds like free promotion, so that's a good
yeah,
idea.
Yeah, it would be really yep. good promotion, and the yeah. Christmas parade's kind of... Yeah, but I mean,
Jackie,
I will not be in...
We don't have a Christmas parade. We have a holiday parade.
It's a holiday parade, but that's okay.
I'm sorry, the
We're
holiday
We're not rejecting
parade.
The idea on account of you misnaming the parade.
Yeah,
so.
See, I told you, just stupid off the dot. Well, but anyway, like maybe things like that in a Carrboro Day to have some kind of
those
presence
are the things,
and
that's right. We need volunteers.
It.
Who's raising their hand? But, yeah, those are the kinds of things we want to do. We want to do some press releases. We want to get some mentions in the local newspapers. I think when these first few plaques go up around town, we also have assembled a lot of names and email addresses, so all those people are being sent the application, and it's a word-of-mouth thing. If you know somebody that has an old home in Carrboro or a historic building, you know, encourage them to apply.
Tom, mm-hmm. About how many homes would currently be eligible?
We used the... this book that some folks have seen, the inventory that was done in the early 80s, and there'd be over 75 buildings that this book, you know, identified that would qualify, and this was by no means a comprehensive list, so, you know, there's quite a few.
We wrote to 150 in the beginning.
Wow.
At that time, we hadn't established the criteria for the age, and we decided 75 years, which is probably the most common age that historic plaque programs use, was a good place to start. The criteria could change if we need more participation or if the needs or the goals of the program shift. So we think that's a good number to get started on. So 1933 is the date. Next year, 1934.
Another decade, we could put a plaque on Bro. So.
This has already been pointed out.
That's right. There's some pictures here of the first plaque that was awarded. It's the John Edward Cole House, and it's 117 West Carr Street. It's been lovingly restored from a disastrous rental property about 4 years ago. It's right at the western end of Carr Street where the Twin Magnolias condominium development is.
Oh, right.
And they have a driveway that's sort of long, so you can't see their plaque from the street. I think if we do a home tour or whatever, they'll probably scoot it out to Carr Street. And then this house, the W.B. Glenn House, is located at 503 Oak Avenue. It's the dark gray bungalow on Oak, a little bit closer to Greensboro. I happen to live there. Marketing promotion I talked about a little bit, and then what we wanted to wrap up with is just requesting a few things from this board, and that is James Thomas has been our liaison by virtue of the fact that the Appearance and Historic Preservation Commission has sort of gotten this thing going. So whether it be he or somebody else to just sort of, if people bring in an application, to put it in a drawer and email us that an application's been submitted in hard copy. We're actually trying to do all this electronically, which will allow us to archive it much more easily. So I don't expect that to be a big staff burden. We would like the town to provide a link and a page where we could post the PDF and Word document application and the resources guide that's in your handout. We're not funded to a point where we can support our own website. It would be great if there was a place somewhere on the town's website where it could host that. So we're kind of saying, you know, we got this program going, but we want it to outlive us and the specific members of the committee. So if the town could kind of own the program, we think that would really help to establish it and ensure its success. The account is, from my understanding, talking to Marty and James, somewhat already been figured out, and that is the homeowners fill out the application, they do the research on their house, they submit it. This is just the process in short. To the committee reviews it, says great, you know, looks like your house is plaque worthy, We agree on a name for the house. That's determined by suggestions from the homeowner or property owner, and then review and approval and final decision made by the committee. And that makes them eligible to buy the plaque. We'd like to collect $135 and use $115 of it for the plaque, set $20 aside into a bucket for promotion, for building brochures, for walking tours, for hosting a website in the future. So just slowly accumulate things in $20 increments. So it would be easier, or it would, I think, make that process easier if they could write the check to the town, not an individual, and then $115 gets recut to the plaque vendor. The plaque gets delivered a few weeks later. The $20 change gets kept in the kitty for the program. The account would, of course, be administered by staff. And then lastly, we are highly recommending that the town kick in $270 for two plaques, one for the Century Center and one for Town Hall, both of which appear to qualify. And if you need help writing the applications, we can help you with that. So without anything further, I'm happy to take questions and proudly say that we're now accepting applications for the historic carpool.
Yeah, I have just a quick question. It's just with regard to the criteria. It seems, and this is just from my understanding, seems to be more building architectural oriented than necessarily maybe who lived there. I mean,
yeah.
If someone lived in an uninteresting house but was a person of note, it seems like it's geared more toward the house. Is that right?
Well, you know, what we try to do is the criteria which are in the packet on that first page, your building has to meet the criteria in order to qualify as plaque worthy. But the application, I think, is written in a way that it's as much about the people as the building. So it's really a combination of both to truly be awarded for a plaque, but the prerequisite, those initial four or five criteria that we outlined, you know, it has to be in the city of Carborough, it has to be in decent condition, it has to be 75 years old, are kind of what get it going. There's a vague one there that says it has to contribute to the architectural and heritage of the town. So that one's the one we're trying to use to catch you know, the interesting folks.
Okay.
If an interesting person or a historic figure has lived in a house that's only 20 years old, the plaque doesn't belong on that house. Mm-hmm. You know, we should commemorate that person in another way.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I think some of the issues that were raised about exactly how the money is handled and the technology issues, or maybe some issues, we'll have to refer to staff for
mm-hmm.
some.
Unless Steve already has an answer to them.
I think we do have most of the questions answered. We need to work out the details on how to incorporate what the group needs with our website, but we have talked about that with Andy Vogel, and we think we can accommodate that. The accounting of the funding for the plaques, we've worked that out. It actually will be a line item in the planning department budget and would be received by the town and expended out through the planning budget, so we can maintain internal control and accomplish what the commission wants. As well, I guess the only thing that we haven't done anything with is that fourth item, and that's the request for the town to appropriate $270 to buy two plaques. I think if the board were interested in that, we could probably find $270 in the board's departmental budget to do that.
Mm-hmm. So. I think that would be a problem. Shouldn't come out of
anybody back
else.
On my paper clips. Yes, Jack.
Yeah, this is an idea that's been kicked around for many, many years. I know Friends of Old Carborough had kicked it around, but nobody managed to get it up and running. So I'd like to thank Tom and Catherine and Richard for putting the work in that finally made this happen. Thank you very much. We'll put a plaque on your house. Richard, is your house ready for a plaque yet?
The house I was born in. Five years.
Okay, and then we can have that you were born in it. Yeah.
There you go.
There we go. Thank you for all of your work on this.
It's a great program.
Excellent.
And do we need a motion?
Okay.
I'll move Resolution A with the incorporation of those points 1 through 4 in the slide presentation.
I'll second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. Thanks very much to everybody who worked on that project. All right. And the next topic is fertilizer.
This is a report on fertilizer. At the June 10th meeting, the board received a staff report on the requirements for year three of the town's NPDES stormwater permit and adopted a town code provision requiring that all turf areas 5 acres or greater follow fertilizer application guidelines. The board further requested that staff report back regarding who the existing fertilizer permit requirements would apply to, as well as how it might apply to smaller parcels. The board also expressed an interest in further discussion of a fertilizer surcharge. The purpose of this item is to provide the staff report and allow for further board discussion on the matter. We've got a pesky fly over here we're dealing with. Randy?
At any time, just send him to his ancestors.
Sarah may be fast enough. I'm not sure I am.
So, as Steve mentioned, we're reporting back to you based on our discussion about this back in June. This was motivated by our NPDES stormwater permit. In addition, as we were coming up with this language for this, we referred to the draft Jordan Lake rules to make sure we were forward-thinking. The way it's written, there's really two ways of compliance. One is through fertilizer application by a certified person or with a plan. As mentioned, there's a 5-acre threshold. That's as was recommended in the Jordan Lake rules. So your question is, who does it apply to? Should the town consider applying these provisions to something lower than a 5-acre threshold? And you also have expressed an interest in continuing discussion on the possibility of a surcharge. Based on your request, we've done an analysis. This has been GIS-based. And I want to explain, I have a couple slides here to make sure you understand the nature of our analysis. Basically, what we did was we don't have GIS data currently that shows us exactly where all the grass is in town, so we had to come up with something. And basically, what we did was use all the data we have that we know is not grass and then see how that defined by visual inspection areas that were in grass. And what I can generally report from that, and have a graphic or two here that hopefully makes it clear, is that we feel that this is reasonable for townwide sort of kind of decision that you're faced with here, but it's definitely not working at a site scale. We really don't know precisely where all the grass is. This is an example. This is Anderson Park. You can see here with our planimetric data, you know, we know where the paved areas are, the roads, basketball courts. We have a coverage that shows where all the trees are. It's okay. It's not perfect. You can see, you know, so this is the area that's in yellowish greenish is the thing that's everything that we know is not something besides grass. The dirt in the infield, you know, we haven't specifically identified that. And there's lots of other examples that site-specific exceptions. This is looking at downtown, right where we are here, the town commons. And if you scrutinize this, you can see lots of areas where there's some tree covers on private residential lots. You know, we did pretty good. We know that this path here, the town commons, is something besides grass. And, of course, all the buildings and paved areas. So that's sort of a nature of the data we're working with to do this analysis. What we did is, you know, we started with 5 acres, and then we scaled down to several different categories, smaller than that, just to look at possibilities for different thresholds. And if you're interested in drilling into some of these numbers, we'd be glad to go there.
Randy,
yeah.
Can you go back? Yeah, on that one. Can you explain just how to read the?
Sure.
Because there's something here that I didn't gel for.
Yeah. So on this axis, this is the cumulative number of parcels affected. So as we go to smaller sizes across this, in this case, the blue line, you know, we read on this axis.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it's not very many parcels that are affected until we get way down here to the smallest size.
Okay.
and then we jump up to, you know, a whole bunch of parcels. And the green line is the number of acres for each one of these categories. So at a 5-acre threshold, we're looking at about 200 acres. We go up to about 300 and almost 400, a little over 400 for 1 to 2 acres and so forth. So I've got some words that kind of summarize all this in a minute.
And that's on this chart.
Yeah, I know, but there was something on in our packet right below that chart that didn't quite make sense. But
is that clarified?
So I can understand it, if you regulated down to lots that are 1 acre or more, you'd be affecting about 2,000 acres, 1,800 acres, 2,000 acres?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry, 1,800 parcels.
Right.
1,800
right. Parcels.
And about 400 acres.
And about 400 acres.
I'm sorry, you'd be about, yeah, 1 acre would be, you know, about 70-some parcels and about 400 acres. Because you have to read the blue line over to this axis and the green line
over to that axis.
Right, yeah. So it was the less than 5 acres. That's where I got stuck. But okay, that's fine.
I should have gone to college. Go ahead.
Gresham makes you stick with
some things. One way we looked at this, we looked at the ownership data to figure out who owns all this land. And the basic summary here is that the single largest landowner is the town. These two categories, two largest categories, these are made up of multiple landowners that have just been lumped into these categories. Actually, the state and the school system is the next single largest owner. Can't really read this, but this is the federal. It's a post office. The county has a little bit of land as well.
When you talk about what the state owns, is that the roads or is that actually
a good deal of it. Some of it's the university and some of it's DOT.
Okay.
I don't necessarily want to belabor all these points, but I will just run through them quickly. That when we look at the total amount of land that's in grass, I say as much as because we think we're probably overestimating a little bit by the nature of what we did, but about a quarter of land is in grass. As much as 80% of lots have some grass. Most of it is residential, overwhelmingly in small patches. Behind residential, the next largest category of ownership is public. Public land is about a fifth of the total grassed area. Proportion of the relatively large patches in public ownership, we looked at four in the table that's in your in the staff memo. We looked at public, business, homeowners associations, and fourth category was, I guess, private. About a third of the grassed areas in patches greater than 2 acres, and there's a fairly limited amount in patches between a half to 2 acres. Some notes. We've assessed what the impact on the town would be, and we believe it's really limited to the Anderson Park fields. The town does maintain the DOT right-of-way, but does not fertilize the right-of-way. It's possible that some private landowners who have abutting the street in the right-of-way, they may be doing some fertilizing. We don't really have any sense of how much that may be going on. And I did want to mention in what we brought before you back in June, there was language included in there that, and it was based on the Jordan Lake rules, that there would have to be state approval of anything we did. And subsequently, in the latest version, the EMC, the Environmental Management Commission, has approved. They've taken that provision out for the types of land we have here in town.
So can I just have a follow-up question? So on the revised ordinance that you provide us, 3D, that's a reflection of the fact.
Right, okay. Right, exactly. Okay. And finally, just as a reminder, back in the spring, summer, we looked at this issue of the surcharge, and we found at that time there was not really any state statutory authority for considering that. So our recommendations, if you were interested in considering something less than 5 acres, we would recommend not going below 2 acres. We also recommend that single-family residences, you consider exempting them because of the potential burden, the potential, as well, I'd say, you know, I think as we've discussed this amongst staff, we feel like, you know, education may be a good mechanism for reaching that audience, and we can include that in our NPDS permit program. As I mentioned, as we already discussed, we're recommending removing the provision for state approval, and then we're just awaiting any other additional direction that you may be interested in providing us with.
Why do you recommend exempting single-family residential?
Well, the primary reason is that, and I'll open this up, and other staff would like to comment, is a couple of reasons. One is that in the state's draft of the Jordan Lake rules, they specifically exempt single-family residential. So there's no...
And what's their reason?
I can think of one.
Their reason is that they're focusing on agricultural land, golf courses, you know, large... They're focusing on streamlining this program to, you know, as targeted an audience to get the most bang for the buck, so to speak. And that they, I believe, also believe that education is a appropriate mechanism. Otherwise, you know, you saw the numbers there. I mean, there's going to be a large number of residents this is going to apply to, and so our
it's 15. So I don't know if that's what you consider a large number.
Well, depending on the threshold.
Right, depending on the threshold.
It's a maximum of 15.
Yeah, depending on the threshold, it would be. If you were interested, it would be especially important if we were to go smaller. But.
Right, but we're not, I don't think we're considering going smaller than 2.
Well, can you go back to the, could you just scroll back to the slide? To that point.
Well, it's really easy to read on this table,
right,
where you see the numbers, where you can see it's up to 15 parcels of single family. And I guess what I'd like to hear is why we wouldn't be concerned about the fertilizer application on those lots in the way we are in, you know, a business lot or a public lot or whatever.
I think, you know, every lot, in that sense, you know, they're all equal. And so I think the main motivation here is considering, as we get to smaller sizes, the return per, you know, the amount of area, we cover more area per lot at these larger sizes, and there's relatively few residential lots at those larger sizes.
Okay, so that recommendation is really more if we went even lower than the 2 acre.
Right.
Okay,
right.
That's reasonable, I think. Thank you.
I suppose this should be obvious, but just to be clear, if we did pass something like this proposal, it would only apply within the town limits as opposed to our planning jurisdiction? Because I only just to point out that there's a big area in our planning jurisdiction that it wouldn't apply to that actually drains to our drinking water reservoir, but it wouldn't apply for the most part to that. Yes.
Does the staff have any information with regards to the 15 residential homes, even if in fact they're using fertilizer? I mean, we may just, instead of passing an ordinance first, we may want to inquire. I mean, there are a lot of people, like myself, who your yard looks the way it is because you don't have fertilizer. I mean, yeah, let's be clear.
Especially if you have 2 acres.
Right. I mean, you just may say, you know, if the grass lives, it lives. If it doesn't, you know. So I guess that's one question I would have.
Yeah, we haven't looked at individual lots at this point, so we don't have any information.
Well, I guess my next question would be, do you know how close those lots are to University Watershed?
I can't.
Or Bowling Creek.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a listing of the property owners, but I haven't tried to get to that level of detail and understanding yet. I'm glad to. I mean, we've got the information, so we just have to compile it for you.
Randy, what would, say these 15 single-family landowners, if they fell under this ordinance, if it were greater than 2 acres, how would they actually satisfy this? Could they, under item A2, the nutrients are applied in accordance with the nutrient management plan, prepared and approved, let's say they choose C1, water quality and professional lawn care, or these ones from the Cooperative Extension Service. Does that mean that they purchase that, obtain that, look at the guidelines and simply follow it? Does it mean they have to get anything back from that?
They use these documents that are listed here, and they prepare a written plan that documents that this is what they're doing, and they have that on file.
And who has it on file?
The individual landowner.
The individual landowner. So yeah. They just basically get this, they develop a plan, and they just keep it on file.
Right. And the alternative would be that they could work with a person who is certified.
Right. Right. Or another publication, or the golf course.
And what would the plan say? Just, sort of
application rates, timing and rates of application.
What's being applied, how often,
yeah.
And in what quantities.
Yeah.
I have a question. The single-family residential is like 91% of the turf. What is, to what extent does that contribute to the nutrient load? I mean, what do you have a sense of? Because I know some of us are really interested in the widespread use of fertilizers, and
we haven't tried to quantify that contribution, so we can't really say at this point. Just qualitatively, the nitrogen that is running off into our streams is either coming from fertilizer, primarily from fertilizer, or from the atmosphere deposited.
Right.
It's probably more of an issue with nitrogen. Phosphorus tends to not be as mobile, and it tends to move only where there's erosional types of problems. So I'm afraid I don't have good quantitative data to provide on that.
So we don't have a way of knowing that, for example, in town along stream corridors where flow is coming from storm drains and coming off, properties that are less than a half acre, less than a quarter acre, whatever, what kind of nutrient load that's releasing?
We have some sense from studies that have been done what the nutrient load is, but we don't have an ability to partition that out into, mm-hmm. A whole number of different sources. That kind of detailed study hasn't been done. This point.
Is that going to be necessary as part of the Jordan Lake rules, or?
It's not mandated, but it's a type of study that would help inform, doing the kind of work to achieve compliance.
Because I'm just wondering sometime in the future if it's not going to be necessary because of just the way the environment's been assaulted to cut back on fertilizers on smaller parcels as well. And I'm just trying to paint that picture. But, I think including the 2 to 5 acres is important for that reason. But I know it only captures a small number. So.
I have a question. I'm trying to figure out what is it that we're trying to accomplish here and how effective this might be, because it's for the small lots, it's voluntary. And for the bigger ones, 5 and up, is the Cooperative Extension Service, and I imagine that affects a few farms that are already doing it.
Well, the farms, I don't believe there are any within the town, the municipal limits. I think they're all in the planning jurisdiction. They haven't been required, since the Jordan Lake rules aren't established, they haven't been required to do this either. They would presumably be working with the county at the point in time when the Jordan Lake rules become effective. But in responding to your question about what the motivation is, I mean, the primary motivation at this point is compliance with our state stormwater permit, our NPDES permit. Mm-hmm. It's actually a requirement for year 3 of our permit. So, you know, we're wanting to satisfy that requirement. That's the part. And, you know, to some extent, we're forward-thinking in our anticipation of Jordan Lake rules.
Okay. Let me ask another question. Is there anything for people who store compost and biosolids? You know, a big farm where there's a pile of mulch and compost and they sell it. I mean, when it rains, all that stuff, you know, I think contaminates more than individual homeowners applying that stuff. Is there something that regulates that, or is that going to impact these people through this ordinance?
It's not something the town regulates, and I can't say for sure if I'm clear on whether the county or the state is regulating the runoff from that at this point in time. If you're talking about the storage and not the...
Yeah, the storage, no applications, but there's people right. Who sell this stuff and store it in big piles.
Yeah, sorry I don't have a definitive answer. Glad to investigate that and okay. Report back.
Thanks.
Well, I'd like to move attachment A, but I would like to include grass areas of 2 acres or more.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded. A resolution receiving staff report.
Does that also include the adoption of the ordinance with the changes?
Well, that's what I was trying to figure out.
Right, that's what it specifies, the resolution.
It's attachment.
Number 2.
Attachment A.
Attachment A. And there's a typo on number 1 in attachment A.
Yes, it's there.
There's a semicolon where there should be a T.
Adopt the town code provision drafted. Okay, so this would...
You're talking about the revised one.
Presumably the revised ordinance that was put in front of us tonight. And obviously...
Yeah.
Changed to say 2 acres instead of 5.
Right.
Can I throw out the suggestion that we also, that assuming that this passes, that we add a resolve clause saying that we're resolved to send a copy of this ordinance to the other local governments in Orange County, you know, with our suggestion that they mm-hmm. do likewise.
Right.
Well, let's not
ask them to endorse.
Right. We won't get too pointed about it. But
I also would like for us, and I'm sure staff would do this anyway, but the affected landowners, the 15, mm-hmm. Make it real clear to them in kind of in layman's, I mean, it's obvious here if you study it, but somewhat in layman's terms, just how to meet the requirements of this.
Just to, I know you've got a motion on, but just to, something to think about, if you're not going to exclude the single family residentials that fall in that 2 to 5 acre category, this is not something that has had any real opportunity for public comment.
It's true. Mm.
And to me, it's the kind of thing that this community would expect, that folks who were affected by this would have an opportunity at least to weigh in before this gets implemented, so just...
Okay, then I'll withdraw my second or ask that the motion be changed to schedule a public hearing.
Right, good idea.
When would that be? Probably January?
Probably, maybe November. I think we could do it on November 25th.
Okay.
All right.
And Steve, would it be possible for, I mean, I know we could find it ourselves, but would it be possible for us to have an example of what the Extension Service recommends, just so we could have it there so we can see and the folks could see?
Is that 2 days before Thanksgiving? Is that what that
is? It is.
Oh.
It'd either be then or January.
January.
Well, because not a lot
people
of people
go away.
Go away.
Like they're out of town.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think as long, you know, let me ask this question to you. The draft ordinance says 6 months from after adoption. What can the staff comment on why 6 months after adoption? Just to give some time to notify the world, I guess.
I honestly don't remember. Was that in the original one that was adopted?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Okay. Well, all I was going to get at is that maybe it would be appropriate then to change it, particularly since we're giving the world a lot more notice that we're taking this action by scheduling a public hearing in January, and given that the spring season will be coming shortly thereafter, that maybe we could modify that to something more like 2 months, you know.
January 27th would be the date.
Or even effective upon
adoption. No, I mean for the hearing, if you don't want to do it in November.
I think we are saying we want to do it in January. Okay. But what I'm saying is then maybe it'd be appropriate to tighten up the time frame for effective date of the ordinance, if that's the case.
Well, maybe not at adoption. Maybe give people a month.
A month, whatever. Yeah, anyway.
You do want to give them some notice.
Well, let me say this. I know nothing about when people apply fertilizers, so I don't, you know, we'll look to staff for some advice about that. But just something that takes into account the relationship of that date to the beginning of the spring growing season. Okay. So it's been moved and seconded that we schedule a public hearing in January. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Thank you very much.
Now, this has been sent to the Environmental Advisory Board and all those folks.
Has this been before the did the Environmental Advisory Board take a look at this proposal?
They looked at it back in the spring as an information item. They didn't. I don't think they specifically made any formal recommendation.
All right. Thanks for your work on this, Randy.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Can't find my agenda. The next item. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Steve's top 10 list.
Well, we don't have David Letterman, but we do have Roy Williford with his top 10 planning department work projects and an overview of EAB recommendations that you all asked for. So without further ado, Roy, take it away. I'm sure you've got a pun or two to throw.
You don't know?
Yes. Okay, slide here. Okay, the top 10. I'm not going to start from the bottom and work my way up. But anyway, what I will do is first of all indicate that I did go through the budget that we adopted as a guide, because that's where our work plan is adopted each year, and tried to reflect on those items that were listed and adopted in the budget and compare that as to what our current work plan is. The Board of Aldermen on August 26, following their approval of the Butler mixed-use project, requested that town staff do two things. One was to go through the EAB comments and recommendations that were given over the last 12 to 18 months, and to particularly those which were not approved by the Board of Aldermen, those recommendations or comments, to see if they could be incorporated into some of the other work that we're doing and what have you. That information is attached in your agenda item. There's probably about 10 pages or so. that lists each project that the Environmental Advisory Board reviewed, the comments they made, and then there are staff notes that are shaded for your information as to where we see those particular recommendations being incorporated into our work program. The next thing that the board asked that the staff provide at that meeting on August 26th was that the planning department provide its a list of top 10 projects, as it was termed. So with that introduction, I will proceed with the top 10 projects that we're working on right now. Okay, the first of the top 10 projects, of course, is the stream buffer update. You just recently received, within the last week or so, a little bit of information, in fact, quite a bit of information on stream buffers and how we propose to modify those buffers so that we can be in compliance with the Jordan rules when and if those are adopted by the state. If you remember this particular document, you may or may not, we did have a presentation on the Jordan Reservoir, its the studies that have been done, and the various components of that reservoir. The stream buffers are shown on this slide. They're in the current ones, and those are the ones that we're currently in the process of modifying. The natural constraints map update, that is the second item, which we're revising the natural constraints map by incorporating updated slope analysis. We're using our GIS. Stream buffer revisions, the ones that we went over the other day, will be incorporated into the constraints map. And we'll seek acknowledgement of the GIS data as representing the best available information for the purpose of development, review, and management. Knowing that GIS is, of course, not a survey, but it does give you pretty good information, particularly with the recent LIDAR information that we received from the state that is very good at studying and showing slopes, and doing slope analysis. A target for completion, winter 08-09. Next item is Northern Small Area Plan implementation. We're working on that to refine the implementation of the Northern Small Area Plan as directed by the board. Strategies include adjustments to the existing policies within the Northern Small Area Plan, new and modified regulations, and rezoning to achieve target densities as well as a desired mix of uses within the Northern Small Area. Target for completion, 2009. Next steps in the NSAPERC review also include the preparation to prepare revisions to the village mixed use ordinance. We expect that in November of 08. Work with property owners on targeted rezonings. If you remember, this map was presented some months ago showing targeted areas up in the northern small area, which we would contact property owners. And next item that was requested was to explore potential for small-scale mixed-use new urbanist form base code developments along arterial roads. That's also in the works. Fourth, to promote mixed-use developments, explore ways to encourage commercial, office, business, residential mixed-use developments in new or developing areas of town, including the Barn Street area. That was added during the review of a project off Barn Street. Target for completion, following item three. This item is, of course, was just recently kind of introduced in terms of NPDES illicit stormwater discharge discovery program. Part of that is, of course, dealing with non-point sources of pollution. With that, we would establish an illicit stormwater discharge discovery and enforcement program, and a stormwater management device inventory and monitoring program is mandated by the town's NPDES permit. Target for establishment of this is November of 08. And the board did receive a report, illicit discharge detection elimination program plan back in May of 08. And there's a link to that if y'all want to go through it. And the Bowen Creek restoration program, that involves removal of the Bowen Creek from the 303D list. That's a list of impaired streams established by the state through efforts of the Bowen Creek Watershed Restoration Team. Thus far, a geomorphic analysis has been completed in 07-08. Here's a picture of that. 319 grant proposal has been awarded to the town of Chapel Hill as a lead agency. We were the lead agency for the geomorphic analysis, and Chapel Hill is the lead agency for the 319 grant proposal. And Carborough will share in the project total. Carborough's share of the project total is approximately $30,000 cash in-kind contribution for each of the next 3 years. Some of the cash contributions can be made up, as I understand, by the Benvic studies that we're currently paying for, as well as the grab samples that we do on, or have been doing with the town of Chapel Hill on a monthly basis. A target for completion of the watershed restoration plan is fall 2011. Next is the Morgan and Bowling Creek Greenway. There's been quite a bit of effort put into this particular plan, and we will continue to assist with its completion of both the Morgan and the Bowling Creek Greenway concept plans. Consultants have thus far been selected by the Greenways Commission. Greenways Incorporated selected for Bowling Creek, and Coulter, Jewell, and Timms for the Morgan Creek study. The Greenway Commission activities update and request for contract approval is scheduled for November 18th of 08. Target completion, fall, winter of 09. And, of course, we still have the comprehensive land use ordinance update, which has been going on for quite a few years. That's not to say that it's such a comprehensive, as the word said, it is comprehensive. And there have been components that have been adopted, of course, over the course of the years. One in particular was a very difficult amendment. I was dealing with incorporating all the FEMA rules and regulations, if you remember those, as well as many of the affordable housing policies and programs and ordinances that the board has incorporated into the ordinance. Over 200 land use ordinance provisions, including parking requirements for land use categories, lighting, tree protection provisions, and miscellaneous or cleanup items have been identified. Changes resulting from an evaluation of the ordinance's concurrency and consistency with Carborough Vision 2020, as well as recommendations for sustainable communities. Recommendations from the Planning Board, EAB, and other sources related to green building. And regulatory measures recommended by the Interlocal Work Group on Water Conservation to ensure that the quality and adequacy of our local water resources. And of course, this is being headed up by WASA. Target for the completion has not been properly identified. That group is still meeting. We're meeting, well, we just had a meeting about a month ago with WASA on this. Ninth is the greenhouse gas emissions inventory. As you know, Orange County is the lead agency for this. intends to complete the greenhouse gas emissions inventory and reduction plan, submit for public input and board approval, develop and promote Carborough's climate change mitigation program. Target for completion will be the summer of 09. And then, of course, we have several planning initiatives which we'll be working on as well. Staff support two transportation planning initiatives in the current fiscal year, including expected completion is noted for each in the parentheses here, The long-range transportation plan, December of 08. The long-range transit plan, November of 08. The draft state transportation improvement program, FY 2011 through 17, that should be presented in December of 08. It's a DOT project. And the comprehensive bicycle master plan, which you just recently received, winter 08-09. And that is that list. And from this, we're asking that that the board accept these top 10 projects as the ones that we're working on and hope to finish, but also to keep in mind that when other projects present themselves, to keep in mind the ones that we're working on and trying to successfully complete.
We do love a plan in this town, don't we?
Oh, we are planning away.
We're big on playing Joel and then Dan.
With the two long-range transportation plan, the transit plan, are they, if my memory serves correct, they are cyclical and they come up every other year.
Not the transit plan.
Not the transportation plan. The LRTP.
Okay.
Both are LRTP, but the top LRTP is a
every other year.
Document.
The TRP.
Okay.
And this, Dan, you wanted to comment on the other LRTP?
I did. No.
Oh, okay.
I have another question.
Okay. Are you?
And then the transportation improvement program in that.
That is a cyclical.
The state transportation improvement program. I believe that's every
two or three years
or something of that nature. It's a long-range capital improvements plan.
So the second and the fourth one are not cyclical?
The long-range transportation plan is one that comes up about every 10 years, I believe. It has to be modified every five years. It seems like it's been 10 times they've actually adopted, but yes.
Well, we're going from the 2030 plan to the 2035 plan.
2035, right.
Okay.
The truth is the state TIP takes so long to develop that it really never stops.
Right.
Begin the next one immediately. But anyway. Dan.
Roy, I noticed that 8 or 9 of these items are anticipating completion over the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And is your expectation then that as these other items complete, you'll be able to focus increasing resources on the land use ordinance update and kind of get to the point where we have a target date established for that?
Is that correct?
Yes.
Generally, what I try to do each year is working with the board, depending on the items that come from the retreat, when the board goes over its priorities and what have you, to add. To look and see what we've accomplished and see what we can realistically add to the work program each year. And so, yes, I would hope we could move forward with and finish up the comprehensive land use ordinance change.
When could you guesstimate when you'd be finished? Just asking for a guesstimate, not a
problem. I would hope we could finish them up within the next year and a half.
Can I add a caveat, Roy? That's if you all are very thoughtful about the additional projects you add.
Well, I was going to ask that. That was my follow-up question.
Depends on how many taco truck emergencies we have.
Right.
And projects that need to be revised a dozen times.
Roy, when we look at something like the revising or updating the land use ordinance, is that something that the work itself really needs to come from your staff because they're the ones with institutional history and so intimately acquainted with it? I mean, is that a task that if a consultant or if help from the outside or if someone were working with staff, would it be as much time to explain it to them as to do a lot of the changes, or does it depend?
Yeah. I think initially it began more of a staff effort to shore up the land use ordinance as directed by the board, knowing that there were special projects that we needed to incorporate along the way, particularly those associated with the affordable housing provisions, the stream buffers. That was something that the board needed done, we needed done, state needed done. So it's been kind of a group effort, if you will. But initially, the staff did go through and try to identify those critical areas.
If we were looking to farm it out, too, we would be looking easily at a six-figure number.
Let me add, I think the answer to your question is yes, that it, particularly when he talks about 200 changes, a lot of those are little specific changes. And I think it does take time to go through them, but it is sort of a collective effort. In order to explain to someone what there will be a huge get up to speed effort,
right.
Unless you just threw the whole thing in the trash and said, let's start over again, then we're talking the six figures.
Yeah. So, okay.
No, there's no way.
I have some comments on the EIB item. Were you going to present anything on that?
No, I wasn't. I did provide those in your package.
So. Okay, but I don't want to do that if other comments.
I just was going to say, I think this is, I think the 10 items you outlined are things that, you know, I kind of anticipated in this agenda item that I might be able to say that some of these things are more important than others, or that, you know, to give you some feedback along those lines. But I have to say, it's a very important list of things that y'all are working on, and certainly I think reinforces the point that we really value the work that all of y'all in the planning department do. So thank you. Dan.
Yeah. What I would like to do is refer this list back to the EAB, and I have four specific questions in mind for them. One would be to look at, I mean, right now this is includes everything from all these particular projects, and I think there's some redundancy across there. So I'd like that redundancy removed. The second point would be there are a number of them that say project-specific, no LUO policy changes identified, and I'd like EAB to consider whether, in fact, in some cases, it might be the fact that although this was project-specific, it might be something that could come up in the future, and in their view, that we should consider. Third is sort of a general reflection on the staff notes as to if there are any items that they have a different take or an additional perspective on what the staff is recommending on how to get there. And the fourth point would be if among all these items that there are any that they feel have an especially great significance that they would recommend that the board prioritize finding a solution for. So, and I'm not meaning to limit it to that, but those are four things that I have in mind that I would like to see as a next step for this list. And I think that EAB, you know, having been the source of these ideas, could take it to that next step. But I don't, in doing that, you know, if anyone wants to
like
work
a motion
on it tonight.
To me.
Yeah, I'll make that as a motion.
To refer it.
Certainly.
Okay. Any comment?
Let's just have a question. Are you expecting, given the list that we had, are you expecting this to be somehow worked in the list as things fall off the list? Or is it expected to come to the board? Because my only concern is that, you know, another year and a half for the land use ordinance revisions, and if we keep adding stuff on, I think the list provided just tonight was partially to get the board to think about some assignment discipline and such that, before I vote on it, I'd like to know what the expectation is. It's not that I don't want the EAB to do it, but I also don't want these other projects to, especially the land use revision, to fall off and be delayed even more. And so that's my concern.
Yeah, I don't have any expectation that this would or would not change our priorities, that it would be further information for the board, and I expect that it would be a very unusual, it would be very unlikely that we would make a change, but, you know, there might be some case of something that perhaps was not a whole lot of work, but that would have the very significant impact that we might want to ask staff to put to a higher priority, but I don't expect, my own view is, I don't expect that anything major would come out of this that we would push up the list of those other items.
I have one comment regarding the EAB, though, that I think might be important in the timing of this, and that is that while I like the idea of having the EAB review and make recommendations, we have two seats that are just now being filled on EAB, so we've got people to get up to speed, and I would defer to Randy. Do you think, how do you see this as being something they can take on? Because
but isn't this a great way to bring people up to speed, to review the last?
Well, that's a great question, but, you know, in terms of what they're working on now, I know that what do you think? Because we've got two new people coming on and four. Yeah.
Randy, shouldn't that be some of a little bit of discussion, though, with the chair and what's on the agenda for the EAB?
Maybe, but before we make that, make the recommendation, which puts it in their lap, I really want to make an informed decision so that we don't have people dropping like flies from the EAB.
But, you know, if they don't get to this until January, you know, to give those people time to have a couple meetings under their belt and get to know each other, then I certainly think that would be fine, if that's what it takes.
Randy, what do you really mean by doing that, and how much staff time will that involve in preparing the EAB to do that?
Right, I want to hear Randy's perspective, because he knows, the other night we had a meeting, we had one person wasn't there, but there's four seated folks right now, correct?
Actually, there's five, and there was two that were absent.
Right, okay.
Yeah. I guess, you know, my reaction is as long as it's not an immediate expectation that they report back, you know, in a month, and you give them some time to process all of this and give staff time to work with them.
So what's a reasonable time frame?
Maybe 3 months, maybe.
There's no time frame in the motion, so it's really whatever is their comfort level and the rest with the rest of their workload and getting into this.
Mm-hmm. Call the question.
Okay. Well, it seems. All right.
Thank you.
So the motion without a timetable attached has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Mr. Manager, consideration of ordinance limiting campaign contributions.
Yeah. This item is to provide you all an opportunity to discuss whether or not you want to direct our town attorney to draft an ordinance which would limit the amount of money that any individual or committee could contribute to a candidate for town office. And, you know, the town got the authority in the last session of the General Assembly to do this. And Mr. Bro prepared a memo that's in your packet, and we don't have a presentation, but he's the person to be responsive to you all's questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Bro? Or does anybody have a proposal on how to proceed?
Yeah, I move that we ask the attorney to prepare an ordinance with the $250 contribution limit that's allowed.
Second that.
Would it be appropriate to go ahead and say that we're going to schedule a public hearing at this time, or do we need to have a separate resolution some later time to do that? Or
we can do that if you want to do that.
Well, clearly we need a public hearing. I agree with you about that, but I meant.
And that we have set a public hearing to consider.
Do you want to do that in January?
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. Is there any other matter from staff?
Well, I was going to do this, but a couple of folks have asked questions about preparations for Halloween, and let me tell you as much about what I don't know as what I do know.
Okay.
We have been working with the town of Chapel Hill as they look at making some changes in the Halloween celebration, obviously, because we share borders. What happens over there has a significant impact over here. Because they're making changes, that's been somewhat slow to develop, and we've been getting information dribbling in over here. I'd hope to have a more complete report for you all tonight, but I simply don't. But I will tell you, we're in conversation with them, and we've made it very clear to the folks in Chapel Hill that we want to be good neighbors, but we don't intend to have the things that they're doing over there be dumped onto the town of Carrboro. So Chief Hutchison and I are trying to get a meeting scheduled with the manager and the police chief in Chapel Hill this week. We're looking at some times to do that. There's some other meetings going on as well, so we will do the best we can. You know, the fact that the park and rides won't be in operation this year will put more pressure on us. It's likely we'll try to do something similar to what we did in 2006 for Apple Chill. You may recall in 2005 we were absolutely gridlocked as a result of that, and we made some changes around our borders which improved the situation in 2006, and I believe in 2001 before my time also with Halloween a similar plan was put into place. So we're looking at those kind of things, but it probably will be the end of the week, maybe the first of next week, before we finalize things. I hope I can give you a more complete report at our meeting next week, but please know that we're on top of it as much as we can be, and we've made it very clear that we plan to protect the interest of the residents of Carrboro.
What was the rationale for closing off the park and ride?
I think it's to discourage
people from parking and riding in.
Where do they think people are going to park?
Well, what they're hoping is that, I think, and is to discourage as many people from coming. But what it's very likely to do is increase pressure on us for people to want to come and park.
They'll park in Carver.
And come over. So we will be putting a plan in place that will limit that as much as possible. You know, we want to make sure that our businesses are taken care of, that our residents can get in and out, that our emergency vehicles can do what they need to do. Chief Hutchison and James Harris are meeting with our local restaurateurs, bar owners in the morning to talk with them about trying to do something similar to what the folks in Chapel Hill are doing so that we can be as consistent as possible. But obviously, because it's Chapel Hill's event, we really have to rely on them taking the lead, and then we have to react somewhat to that because we can't plan for something over here that's not really our event. So what they do impacts us, and we're trying to plan with them as much as we can, and they understand, and I think we've got a good cooperative relationship, but their interest, you know, is for Chapel Hill, ours is for Carrboro, and we'll try to make those two meet in the middle somewhere.
Does anybody know if the Halloween event proceeded like 30 years ago? I mean, I've been here 30 years, and it's been going on. I mean, is it older than that?
I was just a baby, Randy, so I wouldn't know.
Thanks, guys. No, I mean, but some of...
It was not quite the same event.
So it just
20 years ago as it is today.
Even 10 years.
No. I remember it being quite a big deal.
Well, I guess I would ask you when you were last there.
No. When I was first there, it was a big event.
I know, but it's a really big event now.
Right, it's huge, yeah. I go every year.
Yeah, but you go early, I presume. I presume you're not there at 2 o'clock in the morning.
No, I'm not there at 2 o'clock in the morning, but of course not.
You don't have to answer that question.
Yeah. but I mean, this was annoying. This is not a staged event. I mean, this is just organically, it's just grown, right?
Well,
I mean, I'm just wondering if the same kind of you know, just organic, you know, origins will, if Chapel Hill starts to get too tight, Carbro's real close and real funky. And, you know, what's to say that it's just not going to, you know, become a Carbro event at some point?
Because there's not as many places to buy liquor and wine and beer.
And the crowd that's drawn to this, they don't think of Carbro. I mean, they're not in-town people. I mean, early on, it's in-town people, but it's not.
When are they cutting off the alcohol sales in Chapel Hill? What time? No, but they
are.
One.
I see, nothing's. Okay, you hear that, Randy? You got to get in by one.
So mean.
And how does that affect, like, you know, Harris Teeter and supermarkets that are selling beer, and wine? I mean, I'm just curious as to, I know it's a Chapel Hill thing,
James Harris is meeting with the Carbro business owners with ABC permits and so forth tomorrow morning, I think, to discuss some
James
of these
is
issues.
The chief, so.
Because most people that I know who are, you know, obviously, you know, we're middle-aged adults. I mean, they park in Carbro and walk just like for NCAA tournaments or ACC tournaments. You know, that's what they do. So I'm wondering, I'm really concerned about the, you know, the park and ride not being available.
Well, what we will do, I think, as much as possible, again, back to 2006 with Applechill, if folks didn't live here or they weren't advising our officers that they were coming to a Carbro business, then they were asked to go back on out of town. We're not going to be able to stop everything, but our plan would be to limit the number of folks who would specifically be coming Carbro simply to park and go to Chapel Hill. And how successful we'll be,
we'll see.
I don't know, but that's the general idea, unless you won't have, you know, issues with that. That's,
I think you should let in anyone who has a hula hoop.
Well, of course, that goes without saying. I've got one in my garage, so I guess I'll be able to go.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll just see what happens this year.
I mean, this year.
We'll have a year to plan for next year, given what happens this year.
And think of all those political costumes will be out there.
Two quick announcements. One.
Really quick, I just want to remind folks that the opportunity to change the future of North Carolina, the United States, and the world is in our hands on November the 4th. And better yet, you can do it tomorrow right here in the town of Carbro and early voting places. So if you haven't voted, please vote, because the future is in your hands. Thank you.
9 a.m. to 4 p.m. through Saturday, and then Monday through Saturday of the following week. Here at Carbro Town Hall, the final Saturday, November 1st. It ends at 1 o'clock, but the other days it's 9 to 4.
I want to remind everyone that the Transit Forum is tomorrow here in this room. There's actually two forums at 5 o'clock and at 7 to accommodate people's different schedules. I will be at the first one, Lydia will be at the second, and everyone else is, of course, welcome, and people from the public who have concerns or ideas about the transit system.
Thank you.
All right. Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor, signify by saying
aye.
Aye.